Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Project MedTech. I'm your host, Dwayne Mancini. As always, if you have any suggestions for future guests, or if you want to get a hold of the podcast, feel free to email the podcast at projectmedtechpodcast@gmail.com. My guest today is Giovanni Lorcella, or Mr. MedTech. Giovanni is the Vice President of MedTech for the Mullings Group, which is a global medical device talent acquisition and consulting firm exclusively focused on the MedTech industry. In this episode of the podcast, Giovanni and I discuss how he became involved as a global recruiter, what makes a successful MedTech company successful, what makes for a successful executive of a MedTech company, other ventures he's doing, his famous venture capital Excel sheet, and how he is seemingly at every single major MedTech event across the globe. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy my discussion with Giovanni Lorcella.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future, what comes next with Project MedTech.
Giovanni, thanks for joining me on the podcast this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, I mentioned you're the global vice president at the Mullings Group. Maybe talk a little bit about what that job entails to start.
So the Mullings Group and then into the position. So we're a talent acquisition firm that solely focuses in med tech startups.
Okay.
So while we have to be aware of the big guys and all the trends that are existing, we work with that entrepreneurial community with a focus on med tech, like I mentioned. What that means for my role is, globally speaking, I mean, the medical device industry is a global industry. And when it came to building teams for entrepreneurial startups that were pursuing CE mark, but they might be based in Minneapolis or Boston or Southern California or the Bay or whatever have you, and they needed a head of clinical affairs to be able to run their CE mark trial, or after receiving CE mark, wanted to build a field team. We built those teams and we could provide those services. Same thing for Israeli startups who hit that glass ceiling after their R&D and they need to have a clinical trial in Europe or the United States or even China for that matter, and then go commercial. Same thing. So with a very global industry, we have to be able to provide those global services to our clients. And fortunately, that's taken me around the world.
Okay. And that is, we're talking like C-suite level positions all the way down to entry level positions?
So we are, and we love to call ourselves the one-stop shop of talent acquisition for medtech startups. It could be everything from, and it has been everything from, the venture capital firm who hires us for their CEO, portfolio investment company.
Okay.
And that CEO then turns around and says, okay, I need these three to four positions over the next 6 months. And then we work with that CEO in developing that. Or the startup will reach out to us directly. And it could be for a full scale out, building the entirety of the company. It could be for a 5 to 10 person or position project. Or it could be for that one really hard position that they've been struggling with that's hyper technical that they need a Navy SEAL or SWAT team to come in and just solve for them.
Sure.
But to answer your question very definitively, it's everything from CEO or C level down to entry level. And it's everything from very early stage R out of R&D all the way through late stage commercialization and all those technical positions in between.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, you could see the benefit of having someone just focused on the medical device industry, doing that kind of work from you. I mean, it's an impressive network, and it's evidenced by, you know, you and you know, I know Joe Mullings as well, but it's you and Joe, and you could just tell the network you guys have is pretty incredible. So it's incredibly beneficial, I imagine, for a startup company to tap into that network. So, you know, let's talk about, you know, what I asked in my little pre-survey, how'd you start at the Mullings Group? You wrote Craigslist, so I want to get to that, but let's back up first to how you get into this role in terms of, you know, what's your background? What'd you go to school for? You know, how do you get into your recruitment? right? You know, how does that start? And then I got to hear the Craigslist story. So maybe start there and work your way to that.
I think I could tie my answer into answering both of your questions.
I like it.
So any other recruiter or HR or talent acquisition specialist who might be overhearing this in the future, you don't go to school to become a recruiter. Everyone has their own unique story of how they fell into it. Mm-hmm. So that's that. My background is I went to a smaller university in North Miami called Barry University. And I started out majoring in international business. I knew I was addicted to travel from a young age. I knew I wanted to travel the world. And I thought that international business could get me there. At the time, actually, when I was at Barry University, the Times magazine actually said that Barry University was the most international school per capita. And actually being a US citizen was a minority being on the campus. And so I said to myself, okay, well, if that's the case, I'll back off more of the general international business major, and I'll just get that international exposure, of which I did for sure from either the university sending me abroad or my roommates who were from Germany and Turkey and Trinidad, and then spending summers internationally as well, and have a more hyper focus on my major being finance. I'm a numbers guy. I love numbers.
Okay.
And so that's my undergrad. And then I had a brief stint, which is a fun and long story, moving to Costa Rica right after university and then to Colombia. And then I came back to South Florida, and I thought I was actually going to go to get my PhD.
Okay.
And when I came back from Central and South America and applied to University of Miami, got accepted, I was going to do my PhD in international economics, and then found out that the business school and political science school was not going to merge, so that they couldn't offer stipends to their incoming PhD students, but I was more than welcome to pay for it. And at the time, undergrad debt was enough. So I said, thanks, but no thanks. Uh-huh. And at the time of me even getting that situation of not knowing that my next 5 years of the PhD was going to be set for, I was actually working at Starbucks because I was just waiting out the time for my PhD program to start. And I happen to be a lover of coffee, not only just drinking it, but the supply chain behind it. And I just always get fascinated with those stories. So I said, yeah, go do what you love. And so I worked at Starbucks for a little while. And then when I found out that my PhD program wasn't going to happen, I honestly put a seatbelt on, strapped myself to a seat one night, and spent pretty much the entirety of the night putting together my resume and spamming it on every single link in Craigslist.
Yep.
Simply needed a job.
Right.
There's nothing romantic about this story at this
point.
And yep. So I did that. And then about 2 days later, I get a call from Holly Scott, who's at our firm. And long story short, a bunch of details later, I joined the Mullings Group.
Okay. Wow, that's pretty interesting. I got to stop for a second. This has nothing to do with medical device. Are you still like a coffee nut, I guess?
So you won't see it usually at a conference because I have clothes on, but mm-hmm. I actually have a coffee bean tattoo.
Okay,
right on my forearm, right there.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not detailed, but I have two veins right here, and I have the coffee bean right between coffee between my veins. That's how much I love.
I like it. I just got introduced from two of my best friends to like the world of, I mean, I've always drank coffee, but I was never obsessive over, I didn't know the differences in beans, and I still really don't enough. But about 2 months ago, I got into pour over coffee and grind, you know, and like actually grinding down my own beans and everything. And now I'm like turning into this coffee like guru. I'm just learning more and more about it. It's addictive. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's pretty cool. So, you know, traveling the world, this seems pretty interesting. And, you know, I kind of want to get into that a little bit in a second, and we could tie into it. But some of the other ventures you're doing, Mr. MedTech, brand development, right? So let's talk a little bit about that, because it's pretty interesting. I think The first time I was introduced to you, and not really in person, just through LinkedIn, we had connected, was in 2018 at the MedTech Strategist event in Ireland. We were both going there. They have the, you know, they have a great networking app there, and we connected on LinkedIn. And I think at that point, I don't know if you had trademarked Mr. MedTech or at all or anything like that, but you were calling yourself that. So tell me a little bit about that. How'd that come about? Where'd that come from? What have you done with it since then? Because it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. So I'll tell you the actual truth behind it, the true story.
Okay.
So I've been at the Mullins Group and involved with the medical device industry now for coming up on 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated with the industry. Like I am obsessed with the innovation and the entrepreneurship involved in this.
Yep.
So I've turned it into a personal hobby of mine. 2.5 years into the Mullins Group, I really wanted to go back to school. I love school and I wanted to get my MBA, and I was talked out of it by a lot of different people saying I was too young and I should get more experience because just to kind of squeeze the juice out of an MBA. I listened to them. And I said, well, I still want to go back to school and get another degree. And I said, well, what am I going to study? And I said, well, I found this program for Masters of Regulatory Affairs, majoring in medical devices, and you can minor in biopharma. It tells you about all three of them, but you can pick your major if it's medical devices, biotech, or pharma. I chose mm-hmm. medical devices.
Okay.
What I wanted was a degree, first and foremost, but also I might as well have something that heavily educates me on the industry that I'm already falling in love with.
Right.
So I got my master's in regulatory affairs simply for the fun of it. It did exactly what I thought it was going to do, which is really give me a greater understanding of the guts of the industry because it is a regulated environment. Mm-hmm. And after that, I've just been a student of medical device industry, med tech, reading the articles. I have all of my famous websites that I have saved every single morning. I read all the things that attract my eye. I'm an avid reader from cover to cover of MedTech Strategist. I just like to read all the juice about the industry and understand how it flows. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I think calling yourself Mr. MedTech is a pretty bold and brave move.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a lot of entrepreneurs and established CEOs and a lot of mover and shakers that probably deserve the title much more than I do. But the story behind it was I was at a conference in Germany, in Leipzig, actually, in the east part. And it was in the dead of winter in January. There's a conference called LINC, the Leipzig Interventional LINC, L-I-N-K. I forget what it means.
Okay.
Anyway, it's a famous conference.
Sure.
And so I was there and there, it's a 5-day conference, mm-hmm. but on Thursday, the fourth night, there's this famous party that they host for all the attendees, mainly the physicians, but everyone mm-hmm. at the conference is able to go and get a ticket. And underneath Leipzig, the city, is catacombs, Roman built catacombs. So there's like this underground city underneath Leipzig.
Yeah.
So it's a very famous party, and it's one of these things where you're driving in a cab to go there and it's absolutely dark and cold and snowy and frozen out in Leipzig. And then all of a sudden you start walking down these stairs and everything is bricked and old. And I mean, you feel like you're transporting in time, and it's like this underground maze, but it's filled with the thousands of people that you just saw for the past 4 days, and they're drinking beer, and every corner you turn, there's a different band, and the other corner is food. And so it's just this big party. Mm-hmm. And I actually had to fly back the next day, but I had to fly from early, very early, from Leipzig to Frankfurt back to Miami. And, you know, woke up the next morning very early, in a little bit of a haze from the night previous, partying with some German physicians and everyone else in the industry. I just remember having this conversation and talking to myself. And I've always been this guy who, whenever I come up with a cool name in my head, I see if the website is available. I used to collect websites, and then I realized that the maintenance of having websites that aren't being bidded on, or someone trying to buy them from me, or I'm not doing anything with them, just became expensive. So I'm like, stop collecting.
Right.
So anyway, I'm like, Mr. MedTech, it sounds good, Mr. MedTech.
Yeah.
I wonder if the website's available. And so when I landed from Leipzig to Frankfurt, I went on to GoDaddy.com and Mr. MedTech was available. Mm-hmm. And I bought it immediately. And I said, I have no idea what I'm going to do with this website. But in the meantime, no one else can have it.
Yeah.
And you know what? I'm just going to start doing my daily posts on LinkedIn that I have habitually done for years. I'm just going to hashtag Mr. MedTech to see if it does anything.
Yeah.
And it was nothing more than that. It was simply a hashtag that I used on LinkedIn. And the first time that it really sunk into me, I was in TCT, which is a cardiovascular conference. And I remember I was in San Francisco and I'm walking back towards, after finishing a lunch with a client, and I'm walking back towards the conference center. And there's this guy on the other side of the street and he's staring at me like he knows me. I have no idea who it is, but the way he's staring at me, he's like, he's grilling me. He's looking me up and down. And I'm like, what's this guy looking at?
Yeah.
And the light turns green. And so we are able to walk across the street. He's walking towards me. I walk towards, and he's not, and he goes, Mr. MedTech? I'm like, okay. The guy doesn't know my name, but he knows me by Mr. MedTech. Clearly, yeah. The social media branding is working. And then from that point on, I just laid heavy into it and I was to the extreme. And you know, it's funny. I mean, whether or not I deserve the name Mr. MedTech, at this point, I've had some good chuckles with my clients or candidates or simply my network. And if anything, it's done some good branding for me.
Look, it 100% fits. So, you know, the first time we actually talked was what, like a week ago? But I could tell you right now, when I was coming out of the real technical phase and into the business development phase of the med tech and working at, you know, NAMSA and now Covance, and, you know, I started Project Med Tech. When I had first started and I was like, okay, I want to start, you know, learning more about the conference world, from just being on LinkedIn, it was like, this guy is everywhere. I mean, he's at every conference. You know, he's constantly, there is a lot of, LinkedIn is amazing. I love LinkedIn. There's people that post irrelevant things, and there's people who post, you know, really good news stories. And every time I'm on there, I'm like, yeah, look, this guy, here he goes again, posting a good story. Or look, oh, okay, that's great. Every time I stop and read your post, right? They're not useless. That was something that I'm always like, he's at every conference and he's always posting meaningful things, right? So I don't think it's, I mean, maybe there's other people who, you know, could have the title, but in terms of, you know, really unrooted in the med tech industry, think it's a well-deserving title for you. I'm not just blowing smoke.
Thank you.
Yeah. So another venture you're doing is MedTech Money. Is that correct? So maybe talk a little bit about that.
I'm doing the same thing with that, like I did with Mr. Okay. You know, this has been a COVID creativity in crisis situation. Mm-hmm. So, once again, because we focus on those med tech startups as a core business.
Yep.
And we have been hired by those venture capital firms. Over the years, we've amassed this network of investors. Mm-hmm. And very simply put, there's two things that early stage med tech companies struggle with. It's money.
Yep.
And it's people. Mm-hmm. Our core business, we already provide the people. We're not investors, we're not providing the money, et cetera, but we're very good at finding the people. And also because we have this network of investors, why couldn't we also help startups find those investors if they need it, right? So we're not SEC or FINRA licensed, we're not taking commissions off these things, but during COVID when the talent acquisition world got like a deer in headlights, just stuck, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone was stuck. No one really knew what was happening in the very early phases, but you're talking about When I came back from Europe in the mid of March, I was working with 22 active startups and building their teams. And we came out of the gates of January this year white hot. The economy was booming. We were working with a lot of my team specifically. And when COVID happened, I got back from Europe and I went from, by the time of working from home, I think on the end of my third week, I went from 22 down to 6. Mm-hmm. And it was startups that were shut down to never return. It was, the longest story short, a contraction of business, right? And as talent acquisition, we're here for growth and expanding teams while companies were falling off or contracting, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm a people person. I'm a med tech guy. I think of myself med tech first and then a recruiter because I really do love the industry so much.
Yep.
But you know, I said to myself, with our business somewhat in the deer in headlights effect of being stalled out, and we really don't know when it's going to come around, you have two options: do nothing, and you know, freeze up some time to watch Netflix all day and catch up on your shows that you've never seen before, or do something. And to your point on whether it's Mr. MedTech branding or whether it's posting relevant material, et cetera, how was I going to stay relevant with my network during this frozen time period? What, and more important, relevancy is how do I give back to the community and still continue to provide value when our core business is, for lack of a better word, shut down, or freeze rather.
Sure.
And so I simply said, you know, okay, the people aspect is shut down, but companies still need money. And especially those who, and it's been an amazing journey over the past 7 months of hearing hundreds of pitches from startups, connecting with hundreds of investors, investment bankers, and just getting this full 360 view of what is happening with this money flow, which ultimately allows the company to expand and hire more people.
Right.
But it was one of the things where I simply wanted to give back and do what I could. So we simply said, we're going to put together lists of investors and we're going to send them to all the CEOs that we're connected with. And it was really interesting to get this almost sales funnel approach where we send it out to proverbially 100 CEOs. 30 didn't respond, 30 said thanks with nothing else. And then the other 30 gave this overwhelming feedback of, oh my God, thank you for sending me this. You know, we just were at term sheets in March and everything fell apart. We have to start our round all over again. And I was aware of about maybe 30 of the people on your list of 100, but now I have more places to dial for dollars and call on these investors. Thank you so much. And I said, there's something here.
Mm-hmm.
And fast forwarding a lot of white noise, we've now assembled and grown these lists, which has been a lot of data crunching work, I can tell you that, but sharing them with the community. We did a big post initially in June, which got a lot of traction. We did 587 investors, of which then really kicked up some dust where we saw investors proactively coming to us to have their information uploaded to the next list, which then we released in the end of August, which was 810. Now we're currently working on our next list, which is going to be over 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a project that was totally organic. I couldn't have told you where it was going to go, what it was going to be, certainly where we are today with it, and also the conversations, and more importantly, the insight that I've gained from having the exposure to talk to the CEOs who are fundraising, the trials and tribulations of fundraising in general, but also in and during COVID, and then also the investor's perspective as well. So it's been a lot of fun, and there's nothing more glamorous to the story than it was pretty much practically the same thing that happened with Mr. MedTech. Sometime in April, I was walking around outside and trying to get some fresh air, and I was like, MedTech money. I wonder if that's available. And then I bought the website, and now I'm turning it into a hashtag. So
yeah. Look, I appreciate you not buying Project MedTech and leaving some URLs for us. Oh, thank gosh. Thank gosh. I already own that one. Okay. While we're on the topic of money, you know, like you said, finding money can be difficult for med tech startups. I mean, there's definitely money there, right? As you've kind of mentioned in your list. However, it's not as easily accessible as pharma, right? I mean, especially working at Covance, and seeing what a medical device clinical trial costs and a medical device clinical trial for pharma. And if you look at like a Series A round and device versus pharma, I mean, there's a huge difference. So, but let's talk about, some of the difficulties with finding money in med tech, but some advice you have. I mean, you work with a number of different startup companies, you talk to investors, CEOs. So let's do a little bit of that. Advice, difficulties, where that kind of stands there.
So I did a panel discussion last week with a couple people who I know very well, both young CEOs, first-time CEOs raising money. One is from Europe and just about to close on his round, and the other one lives in the United States and actually successfully closed on his round.
Okay.
And dialing in and building my own algorithm on this topic over the past 7 months and the thousands of calls that I've taken, I'm not an expert, I'm not an investor, but this is the information, the market industry information that I've personally received and been able to ask questions on.
Yep.
Any CEO that is close to money or has raised money and is aware of that process, I would be shocked if you found one that disagreed with me, because once again, I'm a conduit, I'm a facilitator. There's not too much originality come from me. I'm able just to be able to take a lot of information in and then be able to disseminate it in a coherent way. That's really my job as Mr. MedTech. Mm-hmm.
But it's important though, just to stop you real quick. I mean, that is an important piece. I just talked to a guy, his name's Gunter Wessels, and he kind of talked about how, there's a lot of knowledge up here, but it's getting that out. And that's sometimes people's, that's more difficult than it sounds. So I think continue. I just wanted to elaborate on that's very important. It's not always about being original or creative. It's sometimes about getting all the knowledge up here out to people or for you to use, but continue.
Agreed.
Yeah.
So the point is there's a lot of people out there who are close to the process who will say, it's not the lack of money that's a problem. There's actually a tremendous amount of money out there.
Okay.
It's really the process and education and also the network to be able to access it. I've had some really fun, cool conversations with CEOs that make raising money just sound almost too easy. Mm-hmm. The major challenges in the trials and tribulations of fundraising, when you really boil it down and you hear some of the war stories that these CEOs have to encounter, they really fall into several buckets of lack of education or just not having been there and done that before. It's like anything else, right? I mean, mm-hmm. You don't go to school to raise money. It's something that you learn, or if you're fortunate enough to have mentors or friends or colleagues or a network that can help you out, that's what you do. And one of the more important questions that I start off with these CEOs who are fundraising, and I ask them, what are the tips that you would give? How would you go about it? You have to start by asking questions. I mean, when you don't know what you don't know, when you can lean on your network and say, what do I do here? What do I do there? And I have some very close contacts that when it talks about how to go about raising money, I mean, you know what it is on the business development side. How have you landed clients? You've done this before and you've landed clients successfully. You've done that before, you've landed clients successfully. You've done this event or this action, mm-hmm. but if you didn't do that, it wouldn't have triggered something to happen in the universe for that person to know about you to come back to you. So I look at raising money very similarly how I look at business development. There's really no one magic way of doing it. There are CEOs who never look at lists of investors. They call their five closest friends who happen to just be overly heavy in influence within the industry, and they can snap their fingers and raise money like that. That does happen. There are also CEOs who come from that sales, marketing, commercial background, and they're now out there raising money for the first time, or maybe have done it before. And because you come from a commercial, sales, business development background, you know what it's like to get kicked in the shins 10,000 times, and it's just that one time that you need for a yes. And that's a huge part of it, right? Because you're gonna have to talk to a lot of people, network a lot, hear your voice a lot, go to bed at night sometimes forgetting who you talked to that day because you had so many phone calls. And if you're not wired that way, if that's not your DNA, and you are a engineer who came up with a great idea, but you don't want to give up the CEO title and you're going to go out there and raise your own money, and you've never had that high volumous sales approach, or you're somewhat introverted, not extroverted, and a people person, you're going to run into challenges. And then also, if you do have that DNA, you'll hear CEOs who have successfully raised money off a cold email. A lot of people tell you, oh, it's all about your network and you need warm introductions. It's semi-true. Those help tremendously. It's not all true. I could rifle off five CEOs right now that have told me, part of my syndicate, there was two investors that were cold emails and it just was the proper messaging. So you have to be able to write well, communicate well, most importantly, tell your story well, and then understand really the psychology of the investors. That's a huge piece. I mean, when you start, when you're an early stage company and you're pitching technology first, you'll likely lose. When you're an early stage company, investors invest in people first. Because when you have a technology that you're pitching on an early stage, whether it's seed round, maybe even Series A, the likelihood of that technology looking the way it does, acting the way it does, having the exact same application that it does by the time it commercially hits patients is, I don't know, I'm probably being generous, but sub 10%, very small. So when you're an investor who's ready to give hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to an early stage company, you have to believe in that person or that small executive management team that you're really investing in those people, not the technology, because there's going to be things that happen along the life cycle of that company that are going to change and you're going to hit hiccups. And do you trust and believe those people are going to be able to get around those or get over those humps? So you have to put your management team out there first. It's really about the people. Of course, it's about the technology in its foundational sense, but you have to talk about the market and you have to know what you're doing. And what I mean by know what you're doing is you don't have to have experience. Like I said, I know CEOs who have raised money for the first time, but you have to sit there and prepare and do the homework. If you put together a mediocre slide deck and you sit there and you spam it out to 10,000 VCs and hope for the best and that's your strategy, you're likely going to fail. But if you do active engagement, you do networking with people, you have the warm introductions, you understand and you research who to reach out to, you know, just because you're looking for an investor and maybe you're raising your Series A, well, what happens if you spend 9 hours with a company that's notorious for only investing in Series C or Series B? You'll likely hit a dead end eventually, and they're just going to do a, meaning the investor is just going to do a brain drain on you. Who knows what they're going to do with the information? Maybe you're under NDA or not, but I've heard of war stories of CEOs who have just literally wasted dozens of hours with investors who never had an intention of actually investing in them because they invested later stage or at a different stage. And so knowing who the investors are in that stage of what you're looking to raise, and also looking for good quality investors that give much more than just money, but support on the entrepreneurial journey, it's huge. So yeah. It's very multifaceted.
Yep. Yeah. Like it's always good when guests make the same points, right? So the people one has been made by a number of my guests. Tim Blair had probably the famous comment, who I know you know, said, you know, investors will take a B horse with an A jockey. And he says that all the time. And the other one was by Anthony Caparso, who runs a medical device company up here in Cleveland called Inhale Medical, or he's the chief technology officer. And he had made the point that said, you know, it was always up till then, he was my fifth or sixth episode. And up until then, a lot of the VCs, you know, it was always, how do you get money? How do you get money? And Anthony kind of came at it as an entrepreneur and said, taking smart money, right? You know, knowing who those investors are, how they're going to behave on the board, you know, how they're going to support you, what kind of value they bring. You know, he kind of said, maybe you should look at it that way instead of just, I'll take any money I can get. Because I think that, you know, sometimes startup companies do that. They get in this panic mode where they're like, I'll take anything. And maybe that's not the best strategy. And that's pretty much what I've heard from, you know, unanimously, is that is not the best strategy. You should come at it from the mindset you described.
Totally. Yeah. I totally agree with that, because there is such thing as smart money. And also, you know, even if it means that you have a startup company, if you're really early stage, maybe you invested your own money in there, or have a partner or whatever it may be, but you're hitting that wall of maybe have 1 or 2 or 3 months runway left before there is no money. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a huge difference between bad money and good money out there, like you just were mentioning. And if it means that you're early stage enough where you don't get into legal and financial problems, where you hit that, I'm out of money and you need a little bit of a 2-3 months of break to start mm-hmm. sitting there and still trying to find better money, it might be worth it. Because once again, it's one thing to say, oh, here's my startup, here's my cool technology, I need money to be able to help put the blood in these veins to help it grow and move and live. But if you actually get on the other side of the table and you understand the inner workings of how venture works, how investors work and think, some of the politics that actually occur between the general partners and the limited partners, and also who drives who with motivation. I mean, you take on an investor, it could dramatically affect your business plan as a CEO of the technology that you might have thought of or are leading at this point. So there's definitely such thing as smart money versus bad money, and bad money could kill your company too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. Okay, so I want to circle back to, you know, how you said you knew from a young age you wanted to travel the world. And you know, part of your bio, you've traveled to 43 countries. I don't know if that's still, if you've increased that at all or not, but I doubt it during COVID. So in your time traveling, you know, you've had to come across a lot of medical device companies coming from all different countries, all different walks of life. You know, what are some of the common characteristics that make a company, a med tech company, successful?
It's not a cop-out answer, and it's probably something that you already heard of, but it's the people, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, when yep. you start getting into later stage companies where, and I don't know if the magic number is 100 people or 200 people or 300 people, but you have to look at it as percentages. And I told you earlier that I was a numbers guy.
Yeah.
You know, when you have a team of 10 and you hire 5 people in a year, that is a massive jump in terms of percentage of how those people affect the company, right? Sure. When you hire 5 people and you're a 200 person company, it has much less dramatic effect on the culture. Mm-hmm. I've seen where you have those 10 people companies or those 30 person companies and you hire one bad hire, it could be toxic for the environment. It could actually be as dramatic as breaking the company, depending yeah. on what position it is. So I can't sit here and say what is a common theme of, you know, well, yeah, okay, class 2 and pursuing 510K or class 2 devices is easier than class 3. We all know that. Less time, less money, and higher chance of either acquisition or simple growth to market quicker. So I don't want to cop out and say that. But, you know, when you look at great leadership, I love the top-down approach. And I hold by this, because when you have a great board of directors mm-hmm. that are communicators and have vested interest in the actual growth and success of the company, that board of directors will not allow for a bad CEO. Mm-hmm. It's actually impossible. A board of directors, if they recognize a bad CEO, they replace that CEO. if you have a good board of directors who approves and there's a good CEO, that CEO is a great leader, has to be a great leader, and won't allow for a bad executive team, VPs, directors, just won't allow for it. If there's a bad one, they get rid of them. When you have those good executives in place, you build a great individual contributor team. So it's literally a top-down approach. And when you have a break in the system, if you have a board of directors that you put together because they're big marquee names, and it's really more for your slide deck to say that X, Y, and Z person is affiliated with my company, and you have a board of directors meeting once every 6 months or once every quarter, and that's really all that it is just to get simple approval. And there's not really a supportive structure between the board and the CEO. It allows for things to potentially get out of whack, right? Which then drive the culture. So what I personally would say is early stage people create great stage, early stage culture, if they're good, starting with a great board of directors and CEO.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. We've kind of touched on it a little bit too. communication and building relationships, right? That's something else that you kind of briefly mentioned. Maybe talk a little bit about the importance of that, because I think sometimes that could be overlooked, and it also could be, it might be a little difficult sometimes or feel difficult. I've had a different experience. So I think sometimes, you know, building the relationships in the med tech industry, it could seem daunting, especially if you're introverted or you're a extroverted introvert. It doesn't matter. Sometimes it might feel as if it's hard. I've had the complete opposite right effect, right? People I've reached out to who I've never talked to, like yourself, Joe Mullings, Manny Villafana, who really has no business returning a LinkedIn message from me, but did. You know, I mean, it's people like that who are very busy, but still take time to, you know, talk to you and entertain it. So, I don't know, talk a little bit about the importance of networking and communicating, and how that could maybe, you know, drive some success for you as a startup company as well. Because you've mastered it.
Communicating, it's really all that we have, right? So you have your thoughts in your own brain.
Yeah.
And the way you see the world is different than the way I see the world. However, the only way that we could help one another or move forward is if we have this ability for effectively communicating. Mm-hmm. And when there's that breakdown in that, that's where problems start, right? I think inherently people want to collaborate and solve problems together. But if the communication isn't effective, that's where the breakdown is. How do you network? Here's a great example. You brought up Manny Villafana. Manny reached out to me in June of this year. And I flew up. I broke my COVID travel spell with Manny in June. I flew up to Minneapolis and spent the day with him there. He drove me around in his car, and we did pretty much a perfect circle around the greater Minneapolis area. He showed me from where he first started his company to CDI that was bought by Boston Scientific, to how he started St. Jude, which is obviously now Abbott.
Yeah.
And then some of his other startups that he's has, and then the one that he's currently working on.
Right.
And then we had this great day together where he was such an amazing storyteller. And then we finalized the day with going to his steakhouse, Manny's, in downtown Minneapolis. And so you're looking at a guy who had heavily influenced by the creation of his technology, what we know in some of the foundational devices in medtech today.
Yeah.
And I mean, who am I, right? And so he reaches out to me and then decides to give me an entire day. We went to the Minneapolis clubhouse for breakfast that morning, and then we jumped in his car and spent the whole day, and then finished off at a steakhouse. Mm-hmm. So there's a purpose for me sharing this story is because I just had a call with a client this morning, for example, and I'm tying this together. The CEOs who don't get their head too big where they're too big for you,
right,
Those are not only my favorite CEOs, but I think that's what makes the best CEOs.
Yeah.
When you're a CEO that puts yourself in the center and you build this 360 team around you, that likely and should be smarter on their siloed professions, much better than you. Mm-hmm. But you prop them up, you drive that culture, and you're humble about that. And you allow that executive leadership and those other individual contributors to do what they do best, and you drive that positive, supportive culture with good, strong communication, high level of transparency, and once again, humbleness. It's human. Mm-hmm. Once again, it's my favorite style of CEO, but it's also the most effective style of CEO.
Yep.
You know, I get it. We can't travel now, and LinkedIn is an amazing platform, which has only enabled people to do high volume blasts and messaging, and everyone's getting bombarded. And, you know, even myself, I could tell you, traveling as much as I did, I have a newfound respect for how much downtime there actually was when you travel that much because of the logistics. I mean, when you're flying to Japan and it takes 14 hours, or you're going down to Australia, or you're flying over to Europe and it takes 9, 10, whatever hours, no one can call you, right? I mean, maybe if you're lucky, you get some internet access and you can do some emails and stuff.
Yeah.
When you're traveling like that, there's a lot of downtime. And it just also goes to show you the value of when you do get in front of somebody at MedTech Strategist in Dublin, for example, and you have that human connection, which I desperately miss these days.
Yes.
Zoom is, I think, or I should say video conferencing is at best a band-aid that personally, and I'm not afraid to say it, eventually I hope it goes away when we all can get back out into traveling.
Yes.
The communication aspect, the leadership aspect, the humbleness aspect, when going back to the bombarding of messagings now with being this virtual world that we're living in, you have to be selective to a certain extent. You know, there are situations where if you have somebody that's, 10 degrees of separations from anything that you could really provide value for, and your schedule is already stacked, and you're just trying your best to obviously maintain as many relationships as you possibly can, because keep in mind, at least my profession, I don't manufacture a product. The only thing I have is my network. Mm-hmm. I'm a people person, and I have to be able to maintain and respect the relationships I have, with the intention of also continuously growing that, but being at least good and communicative enough to manage those relationships as best as possible. But I can also imagine, there are people who get reached out to very frequently where you just simply can't get back to everybody now. You just simply can't.
Yep.
And unfortunately, you have to be able to guard yourself a little bit, but also triage who you can have time for. And I'm on calls from 6 a.m. my time, and sometimes earlier, depending on which country, until I pretty much run out of gas and my voice is hoarse and I'm down by 9 p.m.
Yeah.
And I pass out and I do it all over again the next day. But going back to the humbleness factor, you have to be able to guard yourself, but also those CEOs who are people persons, people, and they simply say, just because I hold the title and I'm running the company, doesn't make me better than you.
Right.
If anything, it just puts into perspective that I need you to mm-hmm. be able to help me build this company. And those CEOs who actually give their time to those who genuinely or at least at a minimum hold value to a conversation, and they don't have that egotistical, I'm better than you, or call my secretary and we'll set something up or not type approach, I think those CEOs go a long way, more specifically and especially for early stage startups. If you're not a networker, if you're not a relationship builder, if you're not a strong communicator, I'll be definitive and say you will fail.
Okay, I like it. So look, that wraps up most of my questions that are related to MedTech. I'll end with one in a second, but other topics that you, Giovanni, are passionate about. If I'm when all this clears and we can go to conferences again, and we're at Medica, we're at MedTech Strategist, we're at any of those big conferences, and you know, I'm so-and-so, and I see you at, let's say we're at JP Morgan, we're at a social event, right? One of the like hundreds of them. And I see you there at the bar and I want to come up and talk to you. What are some topics outside of MedTech, which we know is your number one? What are some other things I can come up and engage you about?
Wine?
That's fair. Okay.
Yeah. I'm not shy of it either. You know, I think the days of getting coffee beans tattooed on my forearms is over.
Okay.
I'm a lover of coffee still.
Yeah.
That's my morning poison.
Mm-hmm.
I fell in love with wine obviously later, but I think I grew out of the stage of having a wine glass or a grape tattooed somewhere on me. So I didn't go that far yet, but what I do love is I do love wine. And once again, it's kind of like coffee. Of course, I love drinking it, but if you can actually get into wine and that culture behind it, whether it's the supply chain of what's it like to be a farmer in Burgundy, France, or
Chianti, Italy,
Adelaide, Australia, wherever it may be, right? So, that's very cool to see how it goes from grapes, to in the bottle and in front of you. I personally love traveling for wine. I was very fortunate pre-COVID that, you know, I don't know what's up with the universe, but a lot of the conferences for med tech happen to either be located in or not too far of a train ride away from a vineyard or at least a famous wine region.
Right.
So, you know, EuroPCR in Paris, I've taken trains over to Champagne and spent the weekend in Champagne. In Spain, I've taken an hour train down after in Barcelona for going to a conference. There's this place called Prirat, phenomenal wine. Israel, hands down, such a cool scientific project. I mean, great wine. A lot of people aren't too onto the Israeli scene outside of Israel.
Okay.
But I could bust that bubble right now and say that they make some amazing wine that is actually fairly eclectic in not the traditional sense of what you get, just Cabernet Sauvignon or Chardonnay. Whenever I'm at a conference there, you rent a car, you make some, and Israel's a fairly small country, so you can cover some serious ground, but you make some client meetings to have that justification as well to go out and meet them and turn it into business. But when the day is done, you drive over to Zikron Yaakov, which is the famous wine region in Israel. You get a couple wineries, you head on over to Jerusalem, do the same thing. So that's the cool stuff. And I just did that in Japan in February.
Okay.
As a lover of wine, I like to try everything. So I don't like just hang on to Chardonnay or Cabernet Sauvignon. I like to branch off and try new different eclectic things.
Yep.
So I didn't even know Japan made wine, for example. But after I was done with my conference in Tokyo, about an hour train ride away, there's a very famous wine region. And hit up a few wineries. It was absolutely incredible. And then I'll sign off with, I even had wine from India when I went to the oldest restaurant in London. It was the oldest Indian restaurant in London, and they served a red and a white made in India. And I was just gonna try that with some curry. It was amazing. That's my hobby. I like to have some fun with it. I like to talk about it. I like to look at it.
Yeah,
not necessarily to drink too much of it, but have fun with the stories.
I like it. So let me end with this. In terms of, you know, how people can engage you, because I know this question is going to come up. Obviously, you know, through the Mullings Group and you're doing the talent acquisition, but do you help companies, you know, outside of that in terms of sitting on being on an advisory committee at all? Has that ever crossed your mind? Being on a board, people asking you to help from like a ad hoc basis with networking and things like that? I mean, I know you said you take in information and then, you know, you're spitting it out, but that could be valuable for a company. So I'm curious, you know, has that crossed your mind yet? Do you do those types of things? Are you allowed to disclose that? I mean, I don't know. I don't know like the ramifications of this, but
Yeah, absolutely. So the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, over the past 7 months of COVID, really great conversations have come about. It's enabled me to have more time to connect with CEOs and delve into more in-depth conversations that might not last longer than a drink at a conference, which has been cool. So I've actually had conversations about joining boards before and the value that I could bring there. It hasn't happened yet, but I can tell you I'm very open to it. I would love to be on a board. I think it would be very cool.
Mm-hmm.
So had those conversations, but also, I mean, on the consulting side, just beyond taking a candidate and talent and putting it into an organization, we've built organizational charts before and structures, and you know, we've been hired by organizations that might be high tech companies who are really building technology that will be regulated as a med tech or a medical device.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have the experience or the talent currently on the team for even the know-how of building their company into a med tech company. And so they're not hiring us simply for a person or a profile. They're saying, hey, listen, we need to turn ourselves into a med tech company and we don't know what we don't know. Can we build out an org chart and you can consult on how that actually happens? So I go in there, I do an assessment of the organization. I talk to all of the executives, what's their strengths, what their weaknesses in, understand what they think is the future 6, 12, 18 months out. Mm-hmm. And then we work together on collaborating on an organizational chart.
Okay.
I have other, it was actually kind of funny. It just happened a couple of days ago. I've never been called this yet and I hopefully am able to live up to the name. But I have a company that's interested in having me come on site and do more of a business strategy session and consulting with them, and called me, well, you're kind of like a McKinsey. And I'm like, okay, well, hold on. I need to be able to live up to that, but I'm sure I can have insights that can help you, but
yeah.
I'm not McKinsey. But yeah, we do consulting on that aspect as well. And also I would say that the famous thing that I will share that I think is a cool story and a stat to get out there. So based on this pivot of med tech money, like I was talking to you about, in,
mm-hmm.
Not only did we just go out and provide these lists of individual, or I should say these lists of investors to these entrepreneurs and the ecosystem, whoever asked for them, what we have been doing is actually making introductions between entrepreneurs, med tech entrepreneurs looking for money and investors. And based on our network of seed or angel investors and groups, early stage VCs, which is really the tough spot, raising that Series A and who's willing to invest in those. Mm-hmm. And then some of the even later stage stuff, Series B, a little bit of Series C. We've been doing high volume introductions. Once again, not SEC or FINRA license, or not taking a VIG on this or a commission, just giving back to the community and helping out these entrepreneurs who are raising funds during COVID.
Yep.
And I take the tally every Monday, and I have to go through my emails over the weekend just to make sure I'm keeping it up. But as of this past Monday, I've made 611 introductions between medtech startups and investors globally.
Wow.
And out of that, thus far, there's been over 25 companies that have actually received money in the bank. And over $30 million raised to date that I've been at least indirectly or directly able to be influential for.
Yeah.
Sharing those lists, making those introductions, et cetera. So it's been a cool little pro bono project to give back to the entrepreneurial community that has actually given me more than $30 million worth of education and insight and understanding how this whole ecosystem works better. So that's.
Yep. It's a great way to give back to the community you love. So that's really cool. In terms of the best way to connect with you, is that generally via LinkedIn?
To start, yes.
Yeah.
You can go on my LinkedIn profile. My email address is readily available. Mm-hmm. Certainly send me an email if you'd like. More importantly, connect with me on LinkedIn so that we do establish that connection.
Yeah.
And so... to start, for sure.
Okay. Yeah. So generally, you know, I include a hyperlink, to well, my LinkedIn profile, but then also my guest LinkedIn profile. And depending on what application, you know, people are listening on, look up or down an inch and you can click on it. I'll take you right there and connect. But I highly encourage him to connect with you. You know, it's something I did years ago, and you know, I've liked your stuff. I've commented on your stuff and you know, the different posts you make, and here we are 2 years later. And you know, we were a guest on my very, very, very early podcast.
Very successful podcast.
Yeah.
Very successful.
Yeah. Hey, so, Bob. Hey, look, I appreciate your time. This has been fun. It's been informative. And I think that, you know, if you're a entrepreneur in the med tech industry, if you're going to be an innovator, if you're just in it in general, these are the kind of conversations, you know, to listen to. And I hope they found it as valuable as I did. And that's really why I started the podcast, right? I want to talk to interesting people in the industry, absorb some information from you, and hopefully other people can listen to it too. So I appreciate your time. You know, hang on for a minute here after I stop it. And we'll continue the conversation just a bit, but, I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's been a pleasure.
Yep. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If any questions or comments for myself or Giovanni, there is a link to our LinkedIn pages in the show notes, or email the podcast and I'll make sure to get you in touch with Mr. MedTech. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review, and feel free to visit the webpage www.projectmedtech.com or send us an email at projectmedtechpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks and have a great day.